She took aim at Kes. Ed readied himself to reflex a drone her way.
I am Alita's hand on this cursed earth. Through my arrow, her will be done!
She released her grip with a guttural war cry. Her bow shot from her hands into a very surprised drone. Alvedra studied the arrow that she was still holding, raised an eyebrow, and then collapsed into Yumiya's waiting arms. The monster hunter deposited the Inquisitor on the ground with a careful motion.
Another victory for Great Uncle Shigo,
Kaga declared offhandedly.
That man was an artist.
He took the weapons away from Alvedra's snoring body with practiced ease. Kes reached him, her face flush with anger.
I told you I'd deal with her on my own,
she told the Kuftar. Kaga bared his teeth and pulled back his ears like a puppy rebuked, but only for an instant.
My apologies, Kes. I must have missed that order while we were dealing with the Inquisitor's two friends. In truth, she should never have come this far. But those two made so much noise, it's no wonder we missed her approach.
By his side, Yumiya nodded. Ed squinted, unsure if he had read the Kuftar right. Is he actually angry because Alvedra managed to sneak past him? Somehow, she had done so in a way that also missed the Kuftar's presence entirely. Tonight, two expert infiltrators had passed by each other without either being aware of the other. If Murmur is watching this, he must think mortals' lives are a black comedy, Ed thought. Kes rolled her eyes at the Kuftars. She gave Alvedra one last sad look, then straightened her back and returned to Ed's side.
There'll be more, Ed, and they'll bring those heroes with them. We need to leave right the fuck now.
There were no more spiders in the camp, and Ed could see men and women moving in a flurry of activity. He wasn't sure if they were coming this way yet, but they would.
I'll go get Scar,
said Levi, who had kept a healthy distance from the action since running out of spells.
By the way, Kaga, I have an ex in the dungeon somewhere I'd like you and your great uncle to meet.
You point, and I'll dart,
Kaga said cheerfully, hiding his blowpipe within the folds of his armor. At that moment, a section of the ground in front of Ed gave way with a rumble, collapsing in a way that created a ramp for the creatures below. There followed the unmistakable crash of a wooden cart stopping the old-fashioned way against a wall of dirt. Ed took a step back as the dust settled. A sweaty Batblin emerged, almost completely covered in grime.
Lord Edward!
Kleck exclaimed, his eyes wide and his ears pulled flat against his head in fear.
The heroes are on their way! We must run!
The Batblin caught a glance of the clearing.
What happened here?
Family reunion, Ed said quietly.
Behind Kleck, the spider warriors were pulling the remains of a heavy-laden cart through the ramp. They seemed cranky.
Let me help you guys with that,
he said, reaching for one of the web strands. At least the cart seemed in condition to move, but he realized that the lid of the web-covered coffin had gotten cracked slightly during the impact.
I hope that Levy didn't exaggerate the vampire's resilience, Ed thought.
If the coffin worked anything like a cocoon, the creature inside wouldn't be able to survive even that small amount of damage. But there was nothing Ed could do about it, except cross his fingers. A Batblin with dark fur and a pointy nose peeked from the cart's tarp at Alvedra's sleeping body.
Ooh, shiny,
he cooed.
Come, Lily, let's hold on to those trinkets.
He gave Ed a guilty grin.
For the hunt, of course.
They hauled the coffin that had started all this mess atop the cart. The family crest drawn on its lid was some mythical creature with many barbed heads and a huge body. Possibly a hairy variant of a hydra.
I hope you're worth it, vampire.
It'd be a shame to have to kill the monster inside after going to all this trouble for it. Kaga jumped atop the cart and grabbed at the reins. He convinced the hell chickens to move by a combination of threats, pull of the reins, screams, and pleads. Scar turned his long neck at one point and snapped at the Kuftar, but Levi clicked her tongue and the mount froze in place. One by one, the hell chickens moved, dragging the cart along with them. Slowly, as they tested the limits of their strength, they gained speed. Kaga guided them, When they left the underbrush behind, they began to gallop. Ed took a deep breath and ran after them. He wasn't even winded when one of the monster hunters reached his side.
Dungeon Lord, we're being chased, the Kuftar told him. A single rider is ahead of all the rest by several minutes. It seems like he knows the forest better than the other Inquisitors. He'll catch up unless we intercept him. Shall we take care of it?
Ed thought it over. An Inquisitor that knew the forest better than the others, and with Alvedra in the same group. It wasn't hard to do the math.
I think that's an old friend.
He wasn't keen on meeting Gallio. The man certainly wouldn't be happy about tonight. But if Ed didn't, Gallio would overtake the cart and probably try to stop them. Then it'd come to violence, and one of them would likely die. Gallio wasn't a bad man. Ed had seen him risk his life during the attack on Barova. They'd fought side by side. That had to count for something. Perhaps he owed the Inquisitor an explanation.
I'll go with you, he told the Kuftar. Alder, you've two utterances left, right? Let's nimble feet to speed things along.
He quickly organized the travel. Kes, Levy, and Kleck would stay behind to guard the cart. Ed and Alder would take Kaga's Kuftars and either catch up or meet them back at the haunt.
Be careful,
Kes told him. She didn't insist on coming along, which said volumes about her state of mind. It wasn't long until they met with Gallio. All Ed had to do was slow down to a stroll, and soon enough the sounds of a horse's gallop through the undergrowth reached his ears. The Dungeon Lord waited with the Kuftars and Alder guarding his sides. Gallio came into view seconds later, riding bareback atop a chocolate gelding. He had changed little since last time they met. Tanned and short, with a strong build and pale blonde hair now kept down to a stubble. A fever burned in his eyes, and his shirt was wet with grime. And his character sheet had his attributes a couple ranks higher. When he saw Ed, he urged his horse forward.
That's the second time you left Alvedra behind in that state,
he told Ed matter-of-factly.
That's far enough, Gallio, Ed said, raising an arm.
He'd seen the Inquisitor's sun wave in action once, and once had been enough to know it was better to stay out of its radius.
She'll be fine. The draft only put her to sleep. It's better than what she intended to do to Kes in any case.
Of course.
Gallio closed his eyes and sighed.
You've gone too far, Edward. Attacking the Inquisition? Stealing our prisoner? I knew this would happen. You went from a well-intentioned young man into a dungeon lord bold enough to oppose the Light's will directly.
Well, perhaps if the Light hadn't filled the countryside with murderous... I don't even know what to call those things, but they sure as hell aren't heroes. Then maybe we wouldn't be forced to defend ourselves.
Despite himself, Ed felt anger bubble in his blood. He attempted to keep his temper in check, but dealing with the Inquisition was like trying to reason with a bully who kept hitting you and then ran screaming to an adult the second you hit back. Gallio shook his head.
That's not how it works. You chose to become a dungeon lord. By that decision, you became the Dark Servant. You are an enemy combatant in the middle of a war zone. You can die or you can surrender, but you can't ask that we leave you alone. And don't give me that look. I know full well you aren't as innocent as you claim. Or have you forgotten the wraith you tried to raise to sentience?
Alder smacked his forehead.
There we go again.
Gallio, you, of all people, should know that things are more than what they look like, Ed said.
And yet, most of the time, they end up being exactly what they insist they aren't.
We killed that wraith while the Inquisition twiddled their thumbs!
Ed's eyes flashed green for an instant. He clenched his teeth and repressed the outburst.
Ione wasn't acting alone, Gallio. Whoever gave him the Bane's egg wanted that wraith out there spreading chaos. I've prisoners that can tell you the same. Their leader, the real culprit, had dealings with a rich Lothian spellcaster. That's about as much as they know, but it means that whoever was behind Barova's attack is still out there. We can't waste time fighting among ourselves. We need to be looking for him.
The Inquisitor's expression was inscrutable. Discreetly, a Kuftar nudged Ed's shoulder. They'd wasted too much time already. It was time to end the negotiations. one way or the other. And it seemed that Gallio had reached the same conclusion.
You can get a prisoner to swear on anything you want. I know this.
He raised his sword in challenge.
But if what you're saying is true, then come with me willingly. We tried it your way before, and it led us nowhere. It's time to trust the light. It's harsh, but only because it must be. Come with me and tell this story to the Inquisition, Edward. Submit to Alita's judgment.
Have you gone nuts?
Alder asked.
You're asking him to go die horribly.
No. I'm giving him the chance to redeem himself.
Enough, Ed said. He spoke in a whisper that dripped cold anger. We're leaving now, Gallio. I advise you don't try to follow. The Haunt will take care of the Lothian. I just thought you ought to know.
He nodded to Alder. The bard fumbled for his flute and lifted it to his lips.
Nimble feet!
Gallio scowled and aimed his sword at Ed.
I'm afraid I cannot let you leave. I'm a sworn inquisitor, Edward. Last time we met, I told you it'd be this way. My duty is to apprehend you or die trying. And no offense, but you don't have enough minions with you to stop me.
Ed's Kuftar raised their fanged scimitars and blowpipes and barked a challenge.
We'll see about that,
one of them exclaimed. Gallio charged. Ed's eyes burned green as he turned his anger into raw will. He still had all his spells, and his chat with the former Barovas sheriff had left him itching to use them. His body tingled with magic as he poured his power into a minor order.
Stand,
he said, his voice charged with mind-altering power. It all happened too fast to see. Triumph shone in Gallio's grin. Ed had tried to use minor order on a seasoned inquisitor who was all but immune to that kind of magic. Raw surprise replaced the inquisitor's grin as his horse rose on its hind legs suddenly, its eyes as confused as Gallio's. Ed watched as Alita's warrior smacked the ground butt first. Terrified, his horse hurried away. To his credit, Gallio was already surging to his feet, unbridled rage marring his face.
And that's our cue, Alder said. Now hurry up! You don't want me entering combat and ending Nimble's effect!
Indeed, Ed told the bard.
As one, they indulged in one of the Dark's greatest traditions, the honorable tactical retreat. With Alder's music powering their legs, they quickly put some distance between them and the Inquisitor. Ed was beginning to think they'd gotten away with it when he heard the scream.
You cannot run from fate, Edward! Sunwave!
We're safe. We're well out of range,
Ed's brain instantly announced, as he activated both improved reflexes and his aura to squeeze a few extra inches out of his stride. Behind him, day replaced the night for a single instant. He had been right. He kept running, with the Kuftars and Alder screaming for their lives as they went. Then the heat reached him. It took him entirely by surprise. His left hand began to heat up under his gauntlet. Nothing worse than a sunburn at first, but the sensation grew and grew. In seconds, Ed's entire hand was burning as if white-hot, without the relief of nerve death. In an instant, it was as if the sun itself was shooting up his veins and into his heart, burning all the way. It was like being cooked alive. Ed screamed and fell, his mind and body unable to handle the sudden, absolute, overbearing agony. The pain reached its zenith. Ed blacked out. You have gained 25 experience for leading a successful raid. Your attributes have increased. Spirit, +1. Your skills have increased. Athletics, +1. Leadership, +2. Your aura's energy expenditure has been reduced. There are new talent advancement options for you. There are new dungeon upgrades available for research. You have a condition. Curse. Weakness to holy magic. Chapter 10. Customer Satisfaction. Hazy neon light bathed the store. A long time ago, there had been a smoke machine, but it was broken now. Probably for the best. Smoke machines and delicate computer parts didn't mix in the slightest.
but good luck convincing corporate of that. A snazzy vaporwave playlist came from the speakers, and the acrid smell of tobacco traveled through the unending rows of electronics like an invisible cloud. The playlist was Lisa's. It was very much her aesthetic, and bringing it to work with her was a way to help forget that her life was only 725 hourly above slavery. The tobacco smell was Miss Olesinska's, and it was probably her aesthetic, too. All of Miss Olesinska's many layers of clothing smelled of tobacco, her remaining teeth were stained yellow, and her tongue was one shade away from black. She was 89 years old, and had driven herself to the Laser Shark store carrying her Dell Dimension XPS R400 in the back seat, cables trailing behind like snakes. Time had yellowed the white case, just like it had done its owner.
"The Facebook is slow. I worry it may have the virus. My grandson is a computer guy, but he told me to bring it to you this time, dear. Better safe than sorry, he said. So here I am,"
Miss Olesinska was saying as Lisa hooked the dimension to the oldest monitor around and booted it up. After the BIOS was done running, Windows 95's cloudy sky greeted her. It was a logo she hadn't seen in a long time.
"This computer is older than me,"
Lisa realized. She was in the presence of history itself.
"He's such a handsome young man, my grandson. I should introduce you to, you know. He's a hard worker. Graduated first of his class last year. How old are you again, honey? Doesn't matter. Meet him anyway."
Miss Olesinska kept on like that, listing off the heroic deeds of her grandson. Lisa opened the Explorer and found the problem. A host of search bars inundated the screen, leaving only a few sad lines of space available for any actual exploring. Half of those bars belonged to companies that no longer existed.
"Sweet dreams, you bastards,"
Lisa thought. It was like stumbling into bloatware's version of an elephant graveyard. Killing them would be a cyber-archaeologist nightmare, like stomping on a fossil. Perhaps she could figure out a way to transplant them into a virtual environment so they could live on. It'd be like having her own retro malware retirement home. The exact kind of meaningless gesture that gave her pleasure.
"Can you fix it?"
"Don't you worry,"
she told Miss Olesinska.
"Here at Laser Shark, we thrive on customer satisfaction. We take care of the problem 100% of the time, or you get your money back, guaranteed."
What she really wanted to say was,
"Don't worry, my fair lady. I shall guard this elder artifact with my life."
Then again, corporate didn't like it when someone deviated from the standard speech.
"I'm glad to hear that,"
Miss Olesinska said, all kindness and smiles. She paid Lisa and promised one last time to introduce Lisa to her grandson. Lisa watched her walk very slowly to her car and fumble for the keys for about 5 minutes. Miss Olesinska drove off in a way that begot both awe and horror. Lisa unhooked the R400 and carried it into the back, which lacked the store's carefully constructed image. The walls were plain white, flaking in spots, and the lighting came from cheap bulbs. There was a water cooler in a corner. The cooling feature was turned off to skim cents off the power bill. Mark sat in front of an IKEA table strewn with disassembled computer parts. He was eating a sandwich and gestured a greeting at Lisa as she came by and searched the table for enough space to set down her beautiful charge.
"Holy balls. Is that what I think it is?"
Mark managed through a mouthful of sandwich.
"Yup. Kneel, guardian, for you stand in front of ancient royalty. This baby rocks a Pentium II killing machine and hasn't seen a USB port before."
Mark set his sandwich away. He bent over the case and took a long sniff.
"Ah, old plastic and a hint of cigarettes. They don't make them like this anymore," he said. "Do you think it can run Doom?"
"Bitch, it can run the shit out of Doom,"
Lisa said, crossing her arms.
"I think the valiant cleric of Owlcrath misunderstands. I already know it runs it. My question was an attempt to introduce the real issue. Are we going to install Doom on this old computer and play it after work? And yes, we could play it on any other computer, probably including the fridges. But this is the authentic experience, Lisa.
Ah,
said Lisa. She grinned.
Interesting.
She sucked at first-person shooters, but so did Mark, and a chance like this was scarce. Most of the old computers that came into the store were non-functional, after all. Someone behind her gave a shy cough. Lisa turned. Mark and she were supposed to be the only ones at the back. The owner of the cough was a kid sitting on a plastic chair right next to the water cooler. He was somewhere between 16 and 18 years old and had brown hair, a dollar haircut, faded jeans, battered sneakers, and a carefully ironed dress shirt. A yellow folder rested on his lap, and he gripped it compulsively with both hands.
"Who are you?"
Lisa asked. Because she was surprised at having missed the kid, the question came out harsher than she'd intended. He shifted in his seat, uncomfortable.
"He's here for the job posting," Mark explained.
"Yeah,"
the kid said, looking down. Lisa turned to Mark.
"So, Ryan's finally getting around to replacing Ed?"
She didn't even remember how long it had been since she and Mark had carried the workload of three by themselves at no extra pay.
"Any time now,"
Ryan would say whenever someone dared bring up the issue.
"And get back to work. It isn't break time."
Mark showed her his open hands.
"Don't think it's by the goodness of his heart. I hear corporate is coming by in a few weeks, and he needs the opening filled to fit the guidelines."
"I see,"
Lisa said. Ryan's office was upstairs. The faint afterglow of his new monitor shone through the windows. A heavy electronic lock guarded the aluminum door. Lisa knew she should be happy her workload would ease up soon, but she couldn't avoid a frown that drew deep lines across her forehead. Her sister, Diana, liked to tell her she shouldn't frown like that because it'd give her wrinkles in a few years. She strolled toward the kid and extended a friendly hand.
"Hi, I'm Lisa, and this one over here is Mark."
"Omar."
The kid accepted the handshake with a sweaty palm.
"Omar, how did you find out about the store?"
she asked. He got a white A4 sheet out from his folder.
"There was an ad with a URL in Woodside's cafeteria."
Woodside was the local community college.
"It brought me here."
Lisa grabbed the A4 and saw that Omar had printed the job listing from the Laser Shark page.
"Now that's something I haven't seen in a long time."
It hadn't changed since she'd used it herself. She realized that she wanted to warn the kid, despite her common sense telling her she should let the matter drop. After all, something had to pay the bills. And what could she tell him anyway? That the listing was grossly exaggerated?
"We have a young, fun, dynamic environment,"
Lisa read aloud.
"That means you'll be working long hours, the foosball table is broken, and that the pay is shit."
Omar nodded. It wasn't as if she hadn't looked for another job. She had, many times, and found none that could count as an improvement in any meaningful way.
"Kick-ass salesman,"
she went on.
"That means you'll get run to the ground with unpaid overtime."
At first, it hadn't been so bad. Retail sucked, but it sucked for everyone, and Laser Shark had originally been just a temporary gig. Just until she could put her degree to work. She had come to Laser Shark knowing fuck all about computers, but she had bonded with Mark and Ed, and a few others who weren't around anymore, over shared hobbies, and they'd given her a hand whenever she had been lost. Nowadays, she found that she liked computers more than she liked people.
"Dynamic workplace. Ryan changes his mind faster than a revolving door spins. You'll be treated as family, not an employee. Oh, boy. I don't know where to begin with this one."
She set the page down. Omar was still nodding. It broke her heart.
"Look,"
she began, but then trailed off.
"Lisa," Mark warned her, reading something in her face.
"You're a gamer, Omar?"
she asked. Of course he was.
"What about RPGs?"
He shared that he was an MMO player,
had cut his teeth on World of Warcraft just like Ed and Mark. He'd fit just right in. And that was the problem.
Cool. So, you know how people joke online about being only an NPC in their real lives? You know, a non-player character. Well, in Laser Shark, we're not really joking.
She wanted to say, but then heard footsteps coming down the stairs from the office. She shut up. Ryan was dressed in a tailored Armani suit with a Zelda t-shirt underneath. His blonde hair was slick and drawn back, and his nose was even more perfect after the cosmetic surgery.
Ah, if it isn't the newest addition to our family.
He extended Omar a handshake, but got too close to the kid as he scrambled up to his feet, forcing Omar to lean back against the wall with his legs bent over the chair as he shook Ryan's hand. Omar's face reddened, but Ryan gave no sign of noticing. He stood back a little. Lisa's lower lip twitched in a repressed scowl. Such a tiny gesture, so easy to chalk up to an honest mistake. Hell, Omar probably thought it had been his own awkwardness getting in the way. The tiny gestures added up, though, and they all advanced the same goal. Ryan making sure he was the greatest person in the room and that everyone else knew it. He probably had read about that power move in one of the books he kept in his office.
Nice meeting you, sir,
Omar said.
None of that. Ryan will do.
He smiled beatifically and flashed Lisa a sideways glance. He'd probably be a fantastic boss for the new hire for a while. At least until he got bored of the charade.
Thank you, sir. Ryan.
So, I heard you talking with Lisa about WoW? I'm a bit of a gamer myself, you know,
he confided.
I'm just like you,
Ryan's demeanor suggested. As long as I like you, I'm just like you.
In fact, we've a little gaming group here in Laser Shark. Mark, Lisa, and I have this game, Ivalice Online. We like to kick the shit in it on the weekends. Maybe you should join us. No pressure, of course, he said.
He patted Omar on the shoulder like a benevolent king giving a subject the chance to prove himself in court. Not for the first time, Lisa wondered what it'd be like to disappear. To just grab whatever she could carry on her back and go. 9 out of 10 missing persons were lying dead in a ditch somewhere. She'd read the statistic a while ago, on some e-rag or another. Perhaps the stats were wrong. Perhaps she loathed herself enough to trust the roll of the dice.
Well, thank you, Ryan, sir. Sounds great. I hope I don't suck too bad,
Omar was saying.
Oh, don't you worry about that. Everyone is a noob at the start, right? No sweat. The group is very newbie-friendly. That's the way I like it. Right, guys?
Ryan smiled again. Yesterday, while they were grinding randomized quests, the group had fought a cluster of horned spiders to protect a camp of Ivalice Online's good guys from some random boss's machinations. They'd earned a nice story quest for their effort, despite initially low EXP and item yield. It was part of Io's charm. All quests had a chance to lead to a dungeon or a final boss battle if you kept at it. Even the small ones. That hadn't stopped Ryan from calling her a dumb cow for forgetting she could use the spell Thunderstorm to force the Spider Queen out of the river. She didn't consider herself a terrible player, but it was hard to think with someone judging your every move and calling out even the tiniest mistake. Could she complain about the cow comment? Sure, but the HR lady was Ryan's aunt, and Lisa had an overdue rent payment. She doubted the dice would roll in her favor.
Sure, Ryan,
was all she said in the end.
All right,
Ryan said.
Well, Omar, why don't you pass by HR to get the last boring minor details worked out? Lisa, Mark, you ought to get back out front, though. You know how clients have a goldfish's attention span,
he chuckled. As she left, Lisa thought about that e-rag and its missing persons stats. Sometimes, late at night, right before falling asleep, when darkness lovingly embraced her consciousness, she wondered about that last 1 person out of 10. The one that made it. she wished she could dream of herself in that person's place. But she never did. Instead, she dreamt of a never-ending dungeon topped by a burnt-out sky where colossal creatures preyed on each other above the fiery clouds, and of the cackling of mad gods across impossibly vast distances. Those nights, she'd wake up covered in sweat, and every time she'd swear the nightmare had followed her to the waking world, that the inhuman creatures with black, beady eyes stood past the feet of her bed and beckoned her closer with a smile full of teeth. But when she blinked, they were always gone. Chapter 11. Dark Patron Wanted. Ed sat at the head of a large wooden table set under the shade of a gnarly tree. Teapots, mugs, and other utensils were cluttered in front of him. Exotic clothes of all shapes and colors covered the chairs, as if their wearers had suddenly vanished and left them behind. The world had a pastel color palette, and the sky above was pink with fluffy blue clouds the texture of cotton candy. A fat caterpillar rested on the other end of the table, smoking from a pipe that left purple rings after each exhalation. Ed looked down and realized he was wearing a blue sundress.
"Absolutely not," he said,
raising an eyebrow. The sundress's fabric extended and changed shape as if responding to his will, and he was now wearing a patched-up suit a size too big for him, thick black boots, and a gigantic top hat that bobbled above his head like a skyscraper.
"A shame,"
said a floating smile right past his left shoulder.
"Blue suited you better, I'd say."
The smile had too many teeth, and a hint of a black, worm-like tongue.
"I was wondering when you'd appear," Ed said.
He sighed and poured himself some tea from the chinaware. Since he was here, he may as well make himself comfortable.
"Weren't you supposed to stay away from me?"
"I liked our previous understanding, Heron." He took a sip of his tea, but was disappointed to find it had no taste despite its appetizing caramel color. The floating smile rippled and waved through the wind, danced past Ed's shoulders, and spiraled to a stop right above the nearest chair. A face white as snow materialized around the smile, followed by the rest of the body. The boatman was a tall fellow, rail thin, with arms and legs that extended like branches. He had no lips, no nose, and no ears. Only a pair of beady black eyes that mocked everything and everyone he set his gaze upon. He was wearing a purple coat fashioned out of a fat cat's pelt, with a rabbit scarf knotted around his neck.
"Don't pretend like you didn't miss me," said Heron.
His sing-song tone masked a faint buzzing that came from his throat every time he opened his mouth. Ed reached for his own head, ready for the splitting ache that accompanied Heron's presence. But it didn't come.
"I'm not actually here, dear Edward. That's why our agreement still stands. After all, this is only a dream."
Heron extended his arms as if making some dramatic revelation. Ed raised his feet and rested them over the table. He forced himself to relax and deny Heron the satisfaction of making him squirm.
"So you can enter dreams, too?"
Heron smiled. His attire transformed into a black and red striped t-shirt and gloves outfitted with razor-sharp knives.
"There's no realm too distant for the reach of Murmur's boatman, Edward."
He flicked his finger knives in playful menace.
"Careful. If you die in real life, you may die in the dream."
"You're spending too much time on Earth," Ed told him. "It's rubbing off on you."
"Well, I could tell you the same about Ivalus. You've gone native, friend Edward. Look at you, all dolled up into a mighty dungeon lord, fresh out of his first clash with the Inquisition, even. And you almost made it out without a scratch.
Impressive. Murmur is pleased with your progress.
Charon used one of his blade fingers to clean a dirty fingernail.
And when Father Dearest is pleased, so am I.
And I don't care, Ed said.
After all his encounters with the human-shaped aberration that was Murmur's envoy, Ed had found that the best way to deal with Charon was to force himself into almost apathy. Otherwise, he risked losing himself into abject terror just by considering the impossibly vast differences in power between a human mortal and the dark demigod.
What happened back there?
Galio's sunwave was out of range, but I blacked out anyway.
He shuddered at the memory of the burning pain. Charon switched back into his cat costume.
Straight to the point, like always.
He served himself some tasteless tea. Since he lacked lips, he poured the drink straight into his open maw.
Ah, let's talk about magic, since your time is oh so valuable. Are you familiar with that game Earth Kids play? The one where you enslave mythical creatures and have them crush your enemies for you? Those creatures are vulnerable to their counter-elements. Well, light and dark magic work kinda like that. Dark magic is all about flexibility and creative interpretations of its effects. Light is a heavy hitter, powerful and to the point.
Makes sense, Ed said, but it doesn't explain why Galio's sunwave hurt me without even reaching me.
As a dark-aligned creature, you're vulnerable to the light's combat spells. But you're not just any dark creature, no. You're a dungeon lord, the ultimate agent of the dark's will upon the world. It would cheapen Murmur's name if any brave farmer and a plucky princess could one-shot a dungeon lord with a single smite. So, your mantle comes with some built-in optimizations, defenses to bridge the light's combat advantage. Dungeon lords are still vulnerable to smites and sunwaves and so on, but not as much as, say, a wraith. But,
he said, waving a finger,
but something happened the night you got that hand of yours, Edward. One accidental interaction between opposing types of magic. Contact with the wraith imprinted some of its characteristics on you, like your drain endurance touch power, and it opened a spectral talent tree that the living shouldn't have access to. It also added the spectral weakness to holy spells onto your character sheet. Like with that game from Earth, your sheet has two different types now, and both of them are vulnerable to light magic.
Ed winced and stared at his black skeletal hand.
So, you're saying I'm half ghost now? Last time I checked, I can't phase through solid walls or create specters at will.
Charon shook his head.
Think of the specter subtype as a smudge on your character sheet. It happened by accident, and it's not optimized. It was sheer luck you got anything useful out of it at all. If you want those spectral talents, you can invest experience points in them, like always. But I don't know what that will do to your body, or your mind. The undead and the living don't mix, obviously, and much less in the same body. It could very well kill you if you aren't careful.
How about if I cut off the damn thing?
Then you'd just be down a hand. The accident changed your sheet, Edward. Those bones are only a symptom, not the disease.
Great.
Ed massaged his temple.
Okay, I can tell you're not done yet.
Best to get all the bad news at once. Charon smiled beatifically.
That's the spirit. And you're right. More bad news. Remember your mantle defenses that Murmur so lovingly built for you? They're gone. All of them. Alita's divine bolt charred them away. If you're keeping count, that makes you thrice as vulnerable to holy magic as a normal dungeon lord. So congratulations. You're the current world record holder. The prize is that in your current state, even a glance from a sun wave is enough to utterly destroy you, no matter how many defensive buffs and enchantments you stack. That's why the heat from Galio's attack sent you straight into unconsciousness. I doubt he knew it had happened. He probably only wanted to scare you and make you dismiss your auras. You made him fall off his horse, after all.
Shit, Ed said. The haunt had just challenged the militant church. This was a disaster. If the Inquisition found out about it, they could bring him down with a snap of their fingers. Does anyone else know about it? He asked.
No, but Galio saw you going down, so he'll know something is up. I'd say you're in a race against time, Edward. Eventually, even if Galio doesn't put two and two together, someone else will.
Okay. Keep calm, Ed thought. Magic had brought him into this mess. It was reasonable to think magic could get him out. In fact, he stared at Charon and narrowed his eyes. The boatman never did things out of the goodness of his non-existent heart. If he had snuck into Ed's delirious mind to explain all of this, it was because he was planning something. The boatman smiled.
Come on, give me some credit. I have been nothing but helpful since we began our friendship. Is it that hard to believe I only want to give you a hand? My plan is to simply give you some advice. What divine magic messed up, divine magic can fix. You need a dark patron, Edward. You know what I'm talking about. Like the deal you have with that Oinus fellow, but with your good friend Charon instead.
He pursed his lipless mouth in a mock pout.
In fact, I admit that the Dark is a bit offended that you haven't given us half the attention you're giving Oinus. A sacrifice here and there could do wonders for your standing, you know. Boons, special talents, more nifty spells like Murmur's Reach. I know you have a dark altar already set up and everything. You would only need to start using it.
Ed raised an eyebrow and said nothing.
It's a sweet deal. Who better to be your patron than your best buddy? I'd give you all the cool stuff. How about creating portals at will once per day? Kings would kill to have my patronage. Hell, the sacrifices wouldn't even have to be virgins. I'm pretty open-minded.
He crossed his arms and stared proudly at Ed.
What do you say?
The dungeon lord lowered his teacup on the table. He tapped the wooden surface as if pondering Charon's offer.
You know, before I worked in IT, I had a brief stint in sales, Ed said. I remember this trick they taught at induction. Upselling, they called it. Turns out, it's easier for a person to make several small purchases than one big one, even if the total of the smaller purchases ends up adding up to more. That's because the human mind has a hard time keeping track of many small investments, and once we're agreeing to one, it's easy to say yes to a couple add-ons here and there. Do you want fries with that? How about tire insurance for your new car? Like that. Ed pointed a finger at Charon. I think I've got you figured out, Charon. You're Murmur's salesman, aren't you?
I've been called many things,
Charon said, with a big grin on his face.
But that one is a first.
To start with, you offer your mark one great deal. Become a dungeon lord. Travel to a new world. There's no commitment to the dark. Don't worry. You are free, you say. Then, once your target agrees, you begin the upsell. Is the Inquisition giving you trouble? Try this new spell. Hey, since you're doing so well, How about you pray to me in exchange for some extra power? And since the commitments you ask are so small, and the benefits so big, people don't realize how much you're actually influencing them until it's too late, and they don't recognize themselves anymore. That's you, Heron. That's what you do. Do you deny it? The Dungeon Lord held the gaze of the boatman. Neither was smiling. The dream had, at some point, lost its friendly coloring. The foliage in the sky seemed faded somehow, as if the cute paint was flaking and you could see the brick underneath.
You know, Charon whispered, many would kill to have me as their patron.
Well, go ask them instead, Ed said. Charon extended a hand, and with a deliberate movement swept the chinaware off the table. Ed stiffened his back and reached under the table for the missing weight of his sword. The boatman's grin was full of teeth, and something oily and dangerous shifted behind his eyes.
There was a time when I walked among the mortals like a tornado passes through a city of glass. Entire civilizations raised immense temples in my honor, hoping I wouldn't pay them a second visit. They waged wars to obtain enough sacrifices to appease my wrath, and the lines of prisoners extended beyond the horizon. My priests worked day and night with their obsidian knives. The currents of blood that ran through the steps of my temples dwarfed those of the sea. You do well to pay me some respect, Dungeon Lord, just in case there comes a time when I walk the walk once again.
The boatman let his words linger in the air for an instant, and then set a hand on the table and rose to his full, inhuman stature.
Anyway, nice catching up, Ed. If you change your mind, just say so and we'll talk like adults. If not, well, any other patron will do, as long as you get one. Even a glancing smite would be enough to turn you into a vegetable in your current state.
He chuckled and allowed the aura of raw menace around him to ease up a little.
That would be a shame, wouldn't it?
Ed unclenched his jaw and watched as the boatman turned transparent and slowly disappeared until only his smile was left. And then even that vanished. The Dungeon Lord was left alone in his dream, and he could feel the waking world coming to claim him. His heart raced in his chest. He stared at the gray sky. For a second there, he'd seen the real Charon, not the quirky persona the boatman liked to put on. Good to know I get on his nerves, too, Ed told himself. Chapter 12. Power Gaming. Ed knew he was awake because his body ached all over, his head spun, and the air smelled of wet batblin. A fuzzy shape obstructed his vision. He groaned.
Ugh. He's awake! A voice exclaimed. Quick, give him some space!
A shame. Without Charon, the lucid dream had been almost nice. Peaceful, even. He wondered if he still had time to go back, if only for a few minutes.
Don't you dare, he told himself. You've too much work to waste time on sleep.
The Inquisition wouldn't vanquish itself, after all. He groaned again and blinked until his blurry vision steadied. Kleck's big puppy eyes stared at him.
I knew you'd wake up,
the Batblin told him, moving back so that Ed could sit. Ed grinned at him.
I'm becoming superb at getting hit. Shame there isn't a skill for it.
Kleck's unwavering faith in him always cheered him up. He was back in his room, naked from the waist up, his legs covered by the bedsheets. Someone had spread a nasty green unguent on his chest.
Around him, the silver magical circles glinted softly.
Actually, there is,
Andrina told him. The herbalist stood next to the bed. She had covered Ed's nightstand with a tray full of assorted herbs, a steaming teacup, and a mortar filled with more green unguent.
It's called first aid. And if you keep waking me in the middle of the night to use it, I'll have it maxed in a couple more years.
Well, I'm always glad to help a master of the arts.
She pushed the cup into Ed's hands.
Drink this, just in case you've got a concussion.
It smelled of peppermint, but was bitter and grassy. Ed wished that Andrina would at least once add a spoonful of honey to her creations. As he drank, Levy, Alder, and Kes entered the room. They had been waiting nearby, judging from the time it took them to arrive. They had changed out of their armor into their usual attire, and other than Alder's shoulders sporting a bandage, they seemed unhurt.
So, we won, Ed told them with a small smile.
It seemed like a safe assumption to make.
I knew it was a mistake to let you go,
Kes told him grimly.
Dealing with Gallio on your own was an unnecessary risk, Ed. We almost lost you.
Alder coughed.
He wasn't alone. I was there, and so were the monster hunters.
He nodded to Ed.
After you went down, the Kufdar carried you back to the caravan. I provided them with bardic support as we ran, of course.
What the hell happened back there?
Levy asked.
Alder told us Galio's sun wave missed, but then you screamed and went unconscious anyway. Were you hit by some other spell?
Ed explained his dream and Charon's visit between sips of tea. Kes paced around the room, a frown deepening in her face as she heard the bad news about Ed's massive weakness to light magic. Kleck sat by the door, a spear in his hand, as if he feared that the Inquisition might come knocking to finish the job.
Charon's visits always get us in trouble,
Levy said when Ed was finished with his tale.
And now he wants to be your patron? What an asshole.
Alder glanced nervously at the shadowy corners of the ceiling. The witch rolled her eyes at him, then went on.
Ed, I know a bit about dark patrons. Warlocks like Chazen take their powers from them, and that's how they can cast more than just a few spells per day. Don't let the name fool you. It is just another form of servitude. If you were to accept Charon's offer, he'd be able to order you around, give you quests, demand sacrifices and loot and whatever magic he gave you in exchange he could take away at any moment.
She puffed her chest.
Witches and wizards may have fewer spells per day, but at least the magic comes from us. As a fellow spellcaster, tell me you won't accept that offer.
Don't worry, Ed assured her. I'd rather get sun-waved again rather than work with him. But that doesn't mean I'll refuse the patron idea entirely. Just to hedge my bets, he assured her, seeing her face redden. Perhaps a small alliance of convenience, like the one we have with Oinus. There has to be some dark demigod or spirit or something that is not an asshole. We, too, are living proof that not all the dark aligned are like Charon.
Levy pursed her lips, but let the matter drop, which suited Ed just fine, because he still didn't know what had happened with the rest of the group after he'd blacked out. He asked his friends about it. Alder filled him in on the small details. Ed had slept all morning, with Andrina assuring everyone he was actually asleep and not in a coma or something. Then Kes took over with the recounting of how they'd escaped in the first place.
It was close,
Kes told him.
Alder and the Kufdar returned with you in tow not 5 minutes after you all left, Ed. It happened very, very fast. We threw you in the cart and ran like hell, knowing that the Inquisitors could easily follow our tracks all the way back home if we messed up.
She kept pacing around the room as she spoke.
I feared that with you unconscious, the drones wouldn't listen to our commands. We'd have been doomed then, because we couldn't wake you up no matter how hard we tried. The drones guided us to the tunnels near Barova, though, just as planned. I think they knew how dire the situation was. We used the tunnels to change directions, and then collapsed them when we were out. I doubt they'll find our trail again, but they know we are nearby. It's only a matter of time before the heroes come knocking.
Ed nodded. Then we better hope that our gambit pays off.
How's the coffin? Levy and Kes exchanged glances. Ed felt a knot of apprehension form in his stomach.
We have no way to know,
Levy said at last.
We left it in a room near Zachary's chapel. The lid is cracked, but nothing leaked out. And there are no signs that the vampire inside is, well, permanently dead. We didn't dare look inside, just in case we jiggled loose something important. Governor Brett and Zachary secured the room in case the vampire tries to escape. You should take a look. I think Brett earned his keep this time.
Got it, Ed told her. He pushed the bedsheets away and stood. Andrina gave him a disapproving look, but didn't stop him as he reached for a shirt, his belt, and his weapons and ordered his drones to help him don his armor.
You think the vampire will appear tonight? He asked the witch.
Only one way to know, she said.
Then let's put the rest of the day to good use, Ed said.
He flashed his evil eye and took notice of the rewards for the battle against the Inquisitors.
I've quite a few unused experience points now. Walk with me while I read the new talent descriptions.
Andrina took her leave.
Well, there's a Batlin with a sprained ankle I must check up on. It's one of yours, Click, so you should pay him a visit later. I'm sure he'd appreciate it. Ed, come see me immediately if you're feeling dizzy. Or if you're feeling anything out of the ordinary. I've no experience dealing with magical after effects, so I can't promise you won't sprout a donkey tail all of a sudden.
Do you guys mind waiting for me in the war room?
Ed asked his friends as he summoned a group of drones and ordered them to help him don his armor.
Sure,
Alder said with a fake shrug. With the bard's high charm, it was no surprise that he suspected Ed was planning something.
Click, Levy, why don't you come with me?
What? Did you suddenly forget the way down the stairs? Oh.
Levy shut up when she caught Alder's meaningful stare.
What the hell? Sure.
Click looked at the both of them as they hurried out of the room, then followed the pair. Kes frowned and headed for the door.
Actually, Ed said, as the drones helped him throw the gambeson tunic over his head. Do you mind staying behind, Kes? I wanted to talk to you about something.
The marshal bit her lip as if she were considering refusing his request. In the end, her martial sense triumphed, so she put on a neutral expression and closed the door.
Yes?
Ed took a deep breath, unsure of how to begin.
It's about what happened back there in the Inquisition camp. With Alvedra.
Look, Ed, we don't have to do this,
Kes said sharply.
No offense, but you're a human from another world and I'm an avian. We don't have enough common ground to have a chat about my feelings, and neither of us are even very good at it.
Maybe,
Ed said. The drones, unaware or unable to understand the situation, barked gibberish at each other as they latched his Greaves' straps behind his leg.
Still, you are my friend, and even if I'm not an old, wise dungeon lord that knows exactly what to say, I'm still here for you. If there's anything you want to say, well, I can listen.
Kes rubbed her eyes with one tired hand full of scars and only three fingers.
Ah, I guess you're right. Sorry about the attitude. It's just that the gods keep shoveling dung into this giant heap and one day you realize it's about to topple above your head. I mean, in other words, there's too much shit going on. That's the thing you say, right? Shit.
The avian used her leg to push a chair her way and took a seat near the bed.
Shit's the right word, Ed said. It's a bit more versatile than dung, actually. You can use it to say a lot of things. Shit's downright fucked. That shit was incredible. Shit just hit the fan.
Is that literal? People in your world like to hit their admirers with dung?
Only on social media and in high school.
I see. It sounds like Volantian politicians to me.
Kes and Ed chuckled, both well aware that the other had no idea what they were talking about.
In her place, I would have done the same thing,
Kes blurted out.
Ever since we are hatchlings, we are taught to mistrust the pacts of dungeon lords. We learn about how devious and cruel they are, and that no matter what, trust in one leads to corruption and death.
I cannot blame Al. No matter how much I'd like to. Back when we made our pact, I thought I was going to die. It's hard to explain. I didn't know the real you. I only